Belgioioso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft the full line of exceptional cheeses guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Belgioioso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Belgioioso, every cheese is a specialty.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Extra Serving, a podcast from Nation's Restaurant News. I am Sam Okus, editor-in-chief at NRN, joined by my wonderful colleague, Alicia Kelso, executive editor. Alicia, welcome.
Hey, good to see ya.
It's spring. I don't know about you. I think you've probably had the same weather as I have had here in Ohio, but it's warmer, it's sunnier, it's more optimistic. This is my favorite time of year now because of the warm temperatures right around the corner. And in general, I think I would say we as a family eat out more at this time of year because of this feeling like we got to be outside. Do you have that same thing, Alicia?
No.
Okay.
I mean, it's busy. We're out. We're very mobile because, you know, Georgia's sports schedule ramps up a bit. It's fun, more fun to be outside. So, yeah,
we eat out more than we do in general, too, just because of more manageable with an older kid, perhaps.
Well, and his schedule is kind of daunting because all of his practices fall smack dab in the middle of dinner time.
Yes. So the food out of necessity, thank goodness for drive-thrus. We are the core demographic for the drive-thru right here. Okay. Well, first off, Alicia, before we jump into headlines, we've got to talk about the fact that this week marks the 5-year anniversary for the COVID-19 pandemic. Wild to think about that it has been 5 years. But I remember it very, very clearly, March 13th, 2020. It was a Friday because it was Friday the 13th, which felt very ominous. And that was the first day that for me, it was our office said, stay home. You have to work at home today. We don't know what's going on. And I remember sitting in my house thinking, oh, cool. I get a Friday to stay home and work. But ooh, kind of cool for a Friday, even though whatever's going on out there. And then we all know what happened after that. And we are 5 years on. Alicia, you just posted on LinkedIn this morning a very poignant sort of recollection of things. And as I recall, too, talking to restaurant sources who would cry on the phone. Mm-hmm. An extraordinarily difficult first 4 or 5 months of COVID when so many employees were being furloughed or laid off. So many restaurants were closing and nobody knew what to do. What is your remembrance of that period of time for this industry?
Yeah, I just remember thinking that this was so critical to cover, but we didn't know how to cover it because it was so dynamic and fast moving and the regulatory pieces were all over the place. I think the hardest part to cover, in addition to the tears, that was shocking. But once, you know, sources cried on the phone, I cried. It was scary. But I think the most interesting part was just talking to the frontline workers when this industry was deemed essential, but workers were just too scared to go to work. And all this data would come out about how the fatality rate was higher for kitchen workers and, you know, so on and so forth. It was just dizzyingly dramatic and terrifying. And and I have a friend who was in the industry at the time who 2 weeks prior to this shutdown, we kind of knew it was happening over here, but it wasn't happening here yet. So you're kind of naive and optimistic that it's not going to happen. Having a conversation about marketing and fun marketing strategies and scent marketing and so on and so forth. And then 2 weeks later, having a conversation that was extremely somber about, you know, plexiglass budgets, PPE. It was just a very surreal time.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the unknown being, of course, the hardest part of it, because it's easy to say now 5 years on and once everything, you know, now we're it almost seems weird that we wore masks for so long. You know, it was such a bizarre time, but we can look back on it now and say, oh, well, of course, we now know how it was spreading. We now know how severe of an issue it was. We now know how, you know, oh, well, a vaccine was developed after, you know, a year and a half or whatever. But not knowing any of that stuff then, obviously, was what made it so hard. Obviously, we all know the details of what COVID was. We're not going to dig into so much into that. I do want to just park it real quick, though, to talk about the change in the industry, because this 5 years has been, I mean, the first year was the most consequential in the industry's history. But just to think then, to take a step back and look at 5 years and how much this industry has changed because of what happened with COVID, I think it's important to point out the digital transformation was completely revved up. You probably remember this, Alicia, but we kept hearing that, you know, 2 years worth of innovation was crunched down to 2 months, or 3 years of innovation down to 3 months. Everybody kept using that kind of language about, well, we have this on our radar for the next couple of years, but we've got to do it now. All the companies rushing to third-party delivery, rolling out their own ordering apps. It was a fire hose for a long time there when it came to especially the digital transformation and innovation within the industry. What do you feel like are some of the most signature ways in which this industry has transformed in the last 5 years?
It's a great question, because I think you kind of have to look at it, from two different lenses. There were a lot of things we got wrong. Pundits, analysts, journalists, even operators. I honestly thought that restaurants were going to be part restaurant, part bodega. And we were going to have like drive-through, formats set up in parking lots of casual dining. There was a lot of creative stuff that came out to stay afloat. Bodegas didn't last. Ghost kitchens probably won't become a trillion-dollar industry that was, predicted back then. That robot servers are not ubiquitous 5 years later. But to your point, there are a lot of things that we got right, too, in terms of prediction. Delivery is here to stay. The consumer has become far more reliant on digital. It was going that way before COVID, but to your point, accelerated significantly. And I think one of the less sexy things that stuck around, but one of the most important in terms of unit economic promotion is just the efficiencies. We are mandated to become a more efficient industry, especially with the disentanglement of the supply chain and the labor shortage, that were products of the pandemic. We just had to become much smarter operators. And a lot of that has stuck around, and for the better.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's so funny you mentioned that about the bodega piece of it, because you're right. We were making all these crazy, even like as a world, people were saying, no more handshakes, no more hugs.
No more like, birthday cakes, what? Yes.
What are you even talking about? Now hindsight's 2020. But again, going back to sort of that unknown stuff. But yeah, I did think that probably my assumption was this industry was going to change more than it actually did, because I was like you. I'm like, suddenly full service restaurants are going to have drive-throughs. Yeah, we're good. The virtual brands are going to be everywhere. This industry, nobody's going to dine in anymore. And as with a lot of things, and we were just talking about this as a team, this notion of a pendulum swinging. Like, you can't ever assume that a pendulum just swings up and keeps swinging up. It does come back down. And I think that, the comeback down on the pendulum is the, oh my gosh, I just want human interaction. I'm going to go into a restaurant again. And for the better of the industry, we normalized. We didn't go full on, casual dining chains have drive-throughs and everybody just eats outside the restaurant. We went back to getting into restaurants, and people want human interaction, want hospitality. And that is a good thing. But I do think we have generally found a balance of, the digital, which is here to stay, off-premises is here to stay. Brands are much smarter in figuring out how to facilitate that, balanced with, once in a while, I do want to get out of my house and I want to go sit down in a restaurant and have in eat in the dining room. So a good balance. One last thing I'll say, the ability with which restaurants were able to quickly pivot, the muscle that they were able to build on being flexible, on learning on the go, I think was really a good lesson, if you could call it that, for the industry. Because I want to point out right now, as we're dealing with the tariff situation, which it's about 11:30 as we record this, so there's probably a new tariff being proposed that will be revoked in the next hour. Just sort of seems how things are going right now. But the tariffs, as we talk to operators about what could they do, Scott Boatwright, CEO of Chipotle, was recently talking about how they're going to diversify their supply chain and look for new sources of avocados, for example, if a tariff on Mexico is made official. And when he said that, I'm thinking to myself, I'm taken back to 2020 and this idea of diversifying the supply chain because of all the borders shut down. Everybody had to find, get creative in their supply chain, in their logistics, and find new sources of, you know, certain ingredients. And now here we are dealing with the tariff situation, and it's like the same thing. And without that, having gone through that lesson during COVID, like, it perhaps wouldn't have been such a normal thing for the companies to do, to say, well, let's just diversify our supply chain like we did 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, agility became much stronger, again, out of necessity. And, you know, I often have interviews with I talk to so many people, and I love the conversation because it always goes back to that. We became smarter operators because we had to. You know, this industry has always had challenges. You and I started covering this industry, you know, during the Great Recession. You know, that there's always challenges in this industry. It is tough. Nothing was like that, though. And, you know, we have to accentuate the positive. And the positive is that we became smarter and more creative. And I would argue more, we've always been agile, but not quite like this.
Totally. Okay. Well, cheers to everybody for out there for
happy anniversary.
I don't know. It's a very somber reflection for sure, but it's good for us to take a minute to look back on what has happened.
How
to
far
remember nothing's a given, to remember there's always kind of crazy curveballs ahead, and it is good to be agile, as you say, to have that muscle. And so here's to hoping that 2025 and beyond won't be as crazy as 2020. All right, let's jump into the headlines. This week, we had a couple doozies, two in particular that we're going to talk about. Let's start with McDonald's. McDonald's announced that they're going to develop this restaurant experience team, which, as CEO Chris Kaczynski said, is really to help them get big ideas to market faster. So they're trying to develop an organizational structure to which McDonald's can not be the cruise ship that has to turn around, but maybe more of a speedboat that can turn around, because they're recognizing there's a lot of players in this industry that are coming at McDonald's that are stealing market share, especially in beef, chicken, and beverage and dessert. These are the specific categories that McDonald's has identified as they are going to have specific teams in place to innovate around those products. And they also have some teams for this restaurant experience team within operations to also similarly innovate in several departments. Alicia, why do you think this is necessary for McDonald's to be doing this?
Well, because it's so big, you know, and it's becoming much bigger. I mean, McDonald's has some significant growth aspirations ahead of it, both domestically and internationally. And when you're talking about a system that big, and to your point, Sam, as we've covered extensively at NRN, you know, these specialists, as Kaczynski called it, they're growing like wildfire. You think of the Dutch Bros of the world, the Seven Brews of the world. And then, you know, on the chicken side, think of, you know, Raising Cane's, Wingstop. And then you've got, of course, the traditional players that are still growing. Church's has a $2 billion ambition by 2028, you know. So I think that McDonald's has been working on this, quote, horizontal structure, you know, since we came out of COVID. I mean, they announced it at the end of 2020. They refined it with Accelerating the Arches 2.0 plan in 2023. All of this had, you know, included organizational restructuring and sort of breaking down silos and segments. And this, to me, is just a continued evolution of that. McDonald's has also been talking for quite some time about their, you know, intensifying focus on chicken. There's a reason for that. The sales at McDonald's for chicken are now equal to the sales of their beef, and McDonald's was founded on hamburgers. That just indicates where the market has been going, what consumers are demanding. Chicken has been, you know, skyrocketing for the past 20, 30 years, and I don't see a slow inside. It's extremely versatile, as we've seen, you know. And then when you have what interests me about this is that experience team is very holistic. So it includes everything from operations and supply chain to, you know, delivery and its innovation lab and franchising. But when you break down the three teams specifically, they're going to be three teams that, like you said, focus on those three categories. It all comes down to what those fast growing specialist concepts are perhaps threatening to erode some of the traffic share. And we've talked about this before. We've written about this before. You know, when I talked to the Taco Bell executives at last year's Live Boss Live, they mentioned one of the reasons they're focusing more on sort of sweets, desserts, beverages, is because it's special intent traffic. And when you've got like a Seven Brew popping up down the street next to a crumble cookie, you don't want to lose traffic, you know, first to someone who just wants a 3 p.m. pick me up. So you're going to create a cookie, you know, that competes directly with crumble to keep them in house. You're going to create some churro shakes or cold, you know, ice brews to compete to again, fortress and protect people and keep them within your brand. I think a point here that is really interesting and that I mentioned in a story that I wrote yesterday, we've seen shakeouts in these specialist categories before. Frozen yogurt comes to mind. Cupcakes comes to mind. There have been rumblings that maybe cookies are headed toward a shakeout because it's that category is getting awfully bloated. But I don't think McDonald's or Taco Bell or Wendy's, which also mentioned beverages and chicken, by the way, as their priority areas for 2025, they're speeding things up for a reason. They're not waiting for a shakeout. They don't want to even, you know, entertain the possibility of losing market share until or if there's a shakeout. They want that traffic now. It is clear the consumer wants specialty beverages. It is clear consumers want cookies, yeah. You know, so that's what they're going for. And they're speeding up the process to get there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Taco Bell. And I may be biased by recent events and headlines, notably last week, as we talked about you going to New York for the Live Moss Live event. But when we saw this news from McDonald's, Taco Bell was immediately what I thought of, because Taco Bell, going back to agility, going back to responding to market demand quickly, Taco Bell is like the playbook for that. Taco Bell moves very swiftly on things and has developed that muscle over the years. It's especially seen in its menu innovation process. And we talked about last week, the doubling the pace of new menu rollouts this year over last year. And it's in response to a lot of this activity going on, a lot of this competition from these specialists, as you mentioned. So when I heard McDonald's is developing this team to act more swiftly, I thought, well, yeah, Taco Bell's been doing this for a while. And so it makes sense for McDonald's to do it. I'm really glad you brought up Wendy's too, because if we really drill in on chicken and beverages and how much Taco Bell, Wendy's, and McDonald's have all come out and said, we are going to focus on chicken and beverages, that is not a coincidence. Don't assume that's some random thing. When three of the top five biggest chains in America come out and say, we're paying attention to this, you should too. Because they are all obviously way out ahead of what's going on in the consumer marketplace. They employ hundreds of data scientists each, I'm sure, to understand what's going on out there. And they've all really zeroed in on beverage and chicken in particular as where their lunch is getting eaten by some of these up and comers and where they also show some particular strength. I mean, for myself, when I go to Wendy's and McDonald's in particular, I'm always chicken sandwich. You know, part of it's a health thing. But part of it's because I really like the spicy chicken sandwich at Wendy's. It's just real good. And so they already have some strength there, but they've said, you know, I don't want Raising Cane's coming in and taking away our chicken occasion. I don't want, you know, Dave's Hot Chicken coming in and stealing away from that spicy chicken sandwich opportunity. So it's extremely important to pay attention to this and recognize that the future of the restaurant industry is going to continue to be very influenced by demand for chicken, demand for beverage. I think to your point, Alicia, demand for that mid-afternoon or mid-morning pick-me-up, that beverage especially can satisfy. And so I just think this moment we're going to be looking back on in the coming years is being like, that was when they all came out and basically said, all right, here we go, game on. We're going after the beverage and the chicken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think too, day parts aren't so tidy anymore, you know? And I think that is playing a huge role in this. Younger consumers are accessing restaurants at all times of the day, which is why late night is also, you know, excessively popular. Those three are not the only ones trying to fortress. You know, Del Taco has a dirty soda. You know, Jollibee just came out with a signature beverage line. We're going to see more of this. You know, there's a lot of companies doing more with desserts. The special intent traffic, it's really critical.
I got to park it just for a real quick tangent, if you would indulge. Just if you would indulge me, I have stopped drinking alcohol on weekdays as a health thing, because God knows I love that glass of wine at the end of the day.
Can I ask a question?
You certainly can.
Okay. Do you allow yourself to drink even more on the weekends? Because
that's a good question. The answer
is... Because that's my approach.
Well, kind of. You and I are recording on a Friday. I might indulge in one extra beer with my pizza tonight, family pizza night. That is true. And hey, you and I, as we know, do enjoy on our work travels a weekday drink. I'm not necessarily giving up on that, Alicia. Don't you worry. More mostly as I approach 40, I am saying, okay, I'd like to take care of this the gut that unfortunately has developed. But I swear this is relevant to our podcast, which is to say that as I turn my eye to more non-alcoholic beverages that I want to enjoy at home, it's really become quite an interesting experience to look at what's around. Because now, on one hand, as we've talked about on the podcast before, I've tried some of these like mushroom based beverages that give you a little bit of a mellow. I've started drinking a lot more ginger ale just because there's something about it that I'm just like, okay, like this is kind of, because what I discovered, and I swear to God, I swear this is relevant, Alicia, bear with me here. Is that what I wanted was something to drink. It's not like I need the alcohol hit. That is nice. But I like the act of just having a drink next to me. And so now on weekdays, I say, okay, let's make it ginger ale at the end of the day. But we've started to look at some other fruit-based beverages. We've started to do a lot more sparkle water. And I know I'm not alone here. And so this is really just to myself, I'll illustrate as if you guys needed this. Help illustrate this demand in beverage, which is like in the late morning, I might go indulge in that, you know, 7 Brew just opened by my house. I might go indulge in that. Mid afternoon, I might look for some new flavor of sparkling beverage. And I am not alone here to want that. Gen Z, especially as they drink less alcohol. I just think like the non-alcoholic beverage category is going to continue to be a force because people want more interesting beverages that are non-alcoholic. And so I'm, as a consumer, I guess I'm trying to say particularly interested in this movement. So.
Yeah, there's something to be said about the placebo movement. And it goes into something bigger about the, you know, we're a little more health conscious. We know a little bit more about what's in our food. When Texas Roadhouse is testing, you know, non-alcoholic beverages and it's doing pretty well, you know that there's something happening. So, right. I mean, they're as traditional as it gets. They're, you know, casual dining as traditional as it gets. So I agree with you that it's going to continue growing. It'll be interesting to see the National Restaurant Association beverage pavilion. Because last year we saw, you know, significant growth in non-alcoholic and THC-based drinks. I think that'll be even bigger this year.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so to button up a couple of the things we talked about, because it segues nicely into the next thing I want to talk about, which is COVID. What changed, to your point, day parts? You mentioned day parts getting really fuzzy. I think COVID really helping there, right? COVID really helps with shaking up day parts and at times of day we're doing things. Also makes a lot of us work from home, as you and I both currently are doing. And what all that has led to is Starbucks now saying that they want to go back to the third place. This is fascinating. All of this very much related, right? Because for the last 5 years, with so much working from home happening, with downtown areas and a lot more of these lifestyle centers losing a lot of the foot traffic for a while, there has been a real push toward drive-through only, smaller footprints, facilitating on the go. Starbucks came out this week. Brian Nichol, CEO, at the shareholder meeting said, they're going to zig where those others are zagging, and they want to actually more invest in the third place, have more dining rooms, more plugs for you to go plug in your computer, set up shop, and work for the morning. This is pretty fascinating because, especially Brian Nichol, he of I'm going to go put drive-throughs in every Chipotle, now saying, you know what, we want to take care of that third place and make it more of a coffee shop experience. What do you make of that, Alicia?
I liked that Chipotle nod. I think it's important that to note that he said several times that Starbucks has the ability to do both. You know, Starbucks can't overcorrect here. They just can't. They have the size and the sales of the business that they have because of their digital customers. He said, you know, he did admit, though, in an act of humility, I would argue that they just went too far. We talked about the pendulum. And in this case, he believes that the pendulum at Starbucks swung too far. He said this before, that the company has become too transactional. I don't know very many people who would disagree with him. And, you know, when you go into a Starbucks now, it's almost uncomfortable because, you know, you're shuffled into this line, you're waiting, you're standing there, and it's very transactional. So this sense of getting back to the third place with new designs, power outlets, couches, as he said, sort of brings the company back to its, quote, sense of purpose. I don't think it's a terrible thing to differentiate here. You know, there are so many drive-through coffee places popping up. Starbucks almost needs to, they're not that, you know. So I think that they have the right to zig while everybody else zags, because the whole sense of purpose that he talked about for Starbucks has always been that third place. They were founded on that very principle. So getting back to that, I think is obviously a very good tactic. And I do want to note that Starbucks is not the only company that has touted getting back to third place. I think this has been a really growing conversation, especially in the past year, that we've touched on, that we've covered to some point. Kava is really in, I think, 60%+ of their consumers dine in. They talk about third place in hospitality, dine-in hospitality all the time. Subway just remodeled, just launched a remodeling program to get people to stay and linger a little bit. Denny's wants to be a third place. They talk about the necessity and the unique position that the restaurant industry has in providing a place for community, or a place for third place, if you will, especially in response to the mental health, crisis that is growing in our country. So there's more of these conversations happening. And I think this is going to be a pretty big part of that. The challenge here is, again, finding the balance, because Starbucks, the whole, the company has moved forward in earnest because of that digital piece.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, it's funny how much this really mirrors everything we were just talking about with COVID, right? Because it is a balance of not whole hog digital off premises. It's a balance of finding still the strength in that, with strength also in the dine-in, sit and stay a while, third place coffee shop experience. They're going to be somewhere in the middle there, and obviously is going to vary by location. One other thing I'll throw out there, this came up on our team call the other day, the fact that work from home is, genuinely in some ways winding down. Our own company is asking folks to be in office more. A lot of companies here in Columbus, I know, have been saying actually 5 days a week, we want you all back in the office all the time. There's a lot of that going on right now, which is, I don't think this is coincidental. I think that work from home will sort of settle into a niche. You and I both hope. And, but that's going to affect this too, right? Because you might have more people in those urban areas where Starbucks used to thrive and then got hurt during COVID. They're back in the urban areas and they're saying, let's go do our business meeting in a Starbucks. So I think that could genuinely impact this as well. The one thing I would caution Starbucks, and the one thing I could see as being a little bit of a barrier, is real estate. Because with this movement toward drive-through only coffee places, one of the big benefits of those spots is they can get real estate a lot more easily and affordably, because you can just grab a corner of a parking lot in front of a Walmart, throw one up with 500 square feet and two drive-through lanes, and you can still facilitate $2 million average unit volumes. And to do the coffee shop with the, hospitality and everything Starbucks wants to really double down on, that is not a 500 square foot experience. That is not a find a corner of Walmart's parking lot experience. That is a, we've got to be much more strategic on our real estate. So it could slow down their growth to some degree if they want to be more strategic in that real estate. But, you know, they're also Starbucks. Like they're going to have the pick of the litter with that real estate if they want it. So I don't know. I'm excited by this to some degree, because as a big coffee shop fan, I think that's the right move to provide the third place. And as somebody who needs to get out of his house once in a while, I seek those out. But I'll be curious to see if that becomes tricky for them to facilitate. Okay, it is time now to move into our extra serving portion of the episode. And to do so, we are going to bring on a colleague of ours to talk about new menu innovations. And if you don't know who it's going to be already, well, I don't know what to tell you. It's Brett Thorne, Senior Yay. Food and Beverage Editor for Nation's Restaurant News. Brett, welcome to Extra Serving.
Hi there.
Brett, we're going to talk about new menu items, but also new menus. We have two companies this week that announced whole new menus. Then, of course, we have the typical plethora of other new menu items that I want to get into with you. But let's start with those two companies that are launching new menus. And one of them is Noodles & Company. Brett, tell us about what's going on with Noodles' new menu.
I mean, they've spent more than a year and a couple of CEOs developing this new menu item. It started under Dave Benninghausen, who hired a restaurant menu consulting firm, The Culinary Edge, to kind of look at the menu. And then he left the company and was joined by Drew Madsen. Drew Madsen joined the company as CEO. There we go. And he really accelerated the development of the new menu. They spent a lot of time consulting with their customers, did a lot of intercepts, and learned that their mac and cheese should be creamier and that their flavors should be more. And so they redid their mac and cheese. They added more cheddar, changed the name from Wisconsin mac and cheese to creamy cheddar mac and cheese.
Get out of here, Wisconsin. We don't need you.
I mean, I guess they wanted to have more national appeal. I don't know. But I talked to Chief Concept Officer Scott Davis about all of this and the amount of work that went into it. And it was a company-wide thing. They not only did they introduce a new menu, which has, as I said, a bunch of new mac and cheeses and a bunch of reworked menu items, as well as a Cobb salad and some broccoli. The entire system went through an overhaul. They improved the training, made sure that all the techniques and procedures were dialed in at all of the restaurants. And then they also have been in the process of rolling out digital menu boards, which are now at about 75% of their locations. And so now they're advertising on the menu boards, not only pointing to the new menu items, but also showing video sort of Chipotle style about how everybody in the back of the house is making the noodles from scratch. And they have like 9 different types of pasta that they cook with. And they, starting over the next couple of months, I think really kicking it off in May, they have doubled their marketing budget to really push awareness of these new items. So it's quite a big deal.
You know, a few months ago, we talked about noodles, and something we talked about in particular was my belief is that noodles lacks identity. I think noodles, they have really kind of staked a claim in sort of global noodles, right? So they want this ability to do Italian and Asian, which is fine. But I think when you're a lot of things to everybody, you're nothing to anybody in some ways. And so I wonder, Brett, do you think in some ways they're trying to like find an identity with this new menu and maybe, you know, to light a spark? Because we all know they need one.
I mean the menu innovations that they've already done, they rolled out 3 pasta items in October and are running a popular LTO with their steak stroganoff. That already has helped turn around their sales a little bit. I mean, same-store sales were up 0.8%, which, you know, in the last quarter, which is better than down, and their higher same-store sales are growing faster in the first quarter of this year. But yeah, they're definitely seeking an identity to own noodles, which kind of makes sense since they're Noodles & Company. I also talked to Scott Davis about their Asian noodle heritage. They had an Indonesian noodle like 20 years ago. Nobody was talking about Indonesian menu items back then. But he said they're also working on that, and we're going to see more Asian noodles in LTOs going forward. But there'll be more bolder flavors, more authentic. Often they're going back to the original noodle preparations that they had. For example, with one of their Asian noodle dishes, they got rid of shiitake mushrooms and were using button mushrooms, and they're revisiting that idea and bringing shiitake mushrooms back and making the cheese cheesier and using aged Parmesan and in general upgrading all the products. Because mac and cheese is their far and away their most popular menu item. So,
because children still exist. You know, for my money, Asian noodles is the right direction because, my impression of it is if I want something in Italian noodles, I can make that at home very easily. I've got boxes of penne and linguine in our pantry, and you just boil it up and make, throw some red sauce and boom. But Asian noodles, that's not something that I would always think about doing at home. So I think that's the right direction for my money. All right, let's talk about Wok-On's. Wok-On's also released a new menu. Tell us about what's going on there.
Well, they didn't just introduce new menu items. They redesigned the menu to have bolder colors and to highlight items targeting women, or actually not specifically women, more specifically team moms, as well as family.
I want to make sure you said team with an M.
Yeah, team with an M.
So that's Alicia.
Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing these are the women who bring in, all the little league kids and say, come on in and eat.
It would be really niche to go after the teen mom demographic. Right. I just want to make it clear.
And not usually big spenders.
Right.
And sports enthusiasts, which has always been their thing. But they also changed one of their categories from Louisiana specialties to seafood specialties. And that targets customers looking for more premium items as well as seafood. And they found that Louisiana wasn't really resonating with their customers. I guess that happens as you expand beyond your Baton Rouge headquarters. And
get out of here, Louisiana. We don't need you. Poor states that are really taking it on the chin this week.
But a lot of the new menu items are really reworked old menu items. And that's true of some of the Noodles & Company items too. Their Cajun-style Boudin sausage now has a pepper jack cheese in it. Their ribeye po' boy it's still on the menu, but they have refashioned it to also be ribeye sliders, which, people like sliders. That makes perfect sense. They've added Havarti cheese to two of their turkey dishes. Again, this is a comment on bigger, bolder flavors that everybody wants. But also very telling is that half of their menu innovation is new cocktails. And they're more Louisiana heritage cocktails. Like they have an espresso martini because you have to, but it has a praline liqueur in it. Praline being a very New Orleans kind of thing. They've upgraded their hurricane, also very New Orleans. And then they've added a spicy mango margarita and a strawberry lemon drop martini, which has strawberry and orange, and a watermelon margarita that's made with watermelon Red Bull, which...
Okay. Huh. Who knew?
Yeah. It's an espresso martini is also sort of an energy drink and a variation on the Red Bull and vodka that maybe you used to drink. Don't know. Or maybe you still do.
Wasn't my jam. No, certainly don't anymore. I don't think my heart.
You're not a team mom. All of that sounds lovely to me.
Not a team mom. No, that's why I couldn't do that.
There's been so much going on with beverage innovation, as you guys know, and it makes perfect sense in many ways, partly because social media loves drinks. I'm not sure why, but like if I post something on social media, if it's a drink, people engage more than if it's food. I don't know why. And also they're very easy to customize and personalize. And so people kind of identify with their own drinks. And as in all categories these days, bigger, bolder flavors is better.
We had a solid 10-minute conversation on beverages before you joined the podcast.
All right.
Beverage innovation being big at Taco Bell, McDonald's, Wendy's. Everybody's talking beverage, and I'm glad it's Friday because you made me thirsty for a cocktail. So, Brett, before I let you go, I did want to give you a chance to talk about the hot new ingredient. You see something popping up on menus everywhere right now. What is it?
Peaches.
Peaches. Who knew?
Especially in drinks. Fat Brands, sister brands, Buffalo Cafe and Native Grill and Wings have introduced a spicy peach wing sauce, and Sunny's Barbecue has a new sweet peach wing sauce. And then it's also in a bunch of drinks all over the place. Like in McAllister's Deli's Leprechaun Lemonade, it has peach puree because they have blue raspberry and then sort of a yellowy peach puree. You got green. But Cracker Barrel has a new strawberry peach lemonade. Scooter's Coffee has a Peach Bliss Quencher. Jamba rolled out a bunch of drinks over ice, which they never had before. And one of them is the Peach Berry Blast over ice refresher. And I'm not sure why peach is happening so early in the year, because like peaches, even in the deep south, they don't come into season for a couple of months till the end of May. I think it might be that it's been a long, cold, lonely winter, and people are anticipating spring. And you do that by having spring and summery kind of menu items. This is something they've actually been doing in Japan forever. There, it's a country that's very, very focused on seasonality. But they, for example, I was in Japan one year in February, and they were already bringing in cherry blossom items, like a cocktail with a brined cherry blossom floating in it, even though cherry blossom season wasn't going to start for another 6 weeks or so. And it's a way of anticipating a season and getting people excited for it. Just like, I guess, with the pumpkin spice latte, like it's introduced in early August now. And that, again, is anticipating the end of the hot, miserable, blistering summer and the beginning of the cool temperatures of autumn.
Revving up those engines. I'm here for it right now when it comes to spring, because as Alicia and I also talked about, spring could not come soon enough. All right, that's all we have today for Extra Serving. Brett Thorne, Alicia Kelso. Guys, as always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Bel Gioioso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft the full line of exceptional cheeses guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Bel Gioioso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Bel Gioioso, every cheese is a specialty.